Hello, this is Mike Harbath with this week's Shoot the Moon podcast, broadcasting live and direct from Revenue Rocket World Headquarters in Bloomington, Minnesota. Revenue Rocket is a premier M&A advisor to IT services companies, and we're thrilled today to have a special guest joining us. In addition to Matt Lockhart and Ryan Barnett, our partners here at Revenue Rocket, Brad Gross, M&A attorney extraordinaire for MSPs. Brad, welcome.
Thanks. Good to be here, guys.
So today we're going to talk a little bit about, you know, sort of the legal process as well as kind of getting deals done. And we're going to fire a few questions, all of us here at Revenue Rocket, Matt and Ryan, at Brad, and kind of get a feel for, you know, his expertise and talk a little bit about where we've touched base and kind of done deals in the past, and then talk more about getting deals done. So, Matt, maybe I'll turn it over to you to start.
Sure. And we are thrilled to have Brad on the program today. You know, we met Brad because we were advising a client that did an acquisition of a firm where Brad was the representative for the firm that was acquired. And, you know, I think we can all pat ourselves on the back that we were able to successfully get that deal done, and everybody was thrilled, and the process was actually really, really efficient. And so, you know, when we heard that Brad also did some podcasting, we thought it'd be a great opportunity to collaborate here. But hey, Brad, you know, why don't you give us a little bit more of your background, how you got into this space, and, you know, what you do. And I know that you got a bunch of expertise and history here.
I appreciate that. Thank you. So, yes, we did have prior experience together. So that's a great thing, right? You can always gauge somebody based on real life experience. That's what you want to do. My background in 60 seconds or less is I started out as a computer hacker at the age of 11, and I became a lawyer many, many years later. The path between hacker and lawyer was an interesting one. It started out in the DA's office up in Nassau, New York, and as well as in Miami-Dade, Florida. And I was representing technology companies when I went into the civil end of things outside of criminal law. And I've been doing that for about 20 years. And the benefit or the true value that I bring and my firm brings to any transaction is that not only do we understand the players in the industry since we've been doing this so long, we understand the technologies as well. So the underlying technologies that are being used by sellers and being acquired by buyers are things that we're not only familiar with, we've been familiar with them for years. So that helps. Right. That helps when you're involved in a deal where the assets are not just unknown quantities or fungible items, but they're actually services or products and so forth that that we have a great deal of familiarity with. And so we have been representing both buyers and sellers, depending on the deal, in the MSP space for well over a decade. And really looking forward to chatting with you guys about it today.
Well, that's awesome. Ryan, you know, is our sort of moderator extraordinaire. So, you know, Ryan, why don't we jump in and talk turkey?
Well, absolutely. And Brad, thanks for being on here today. And I'm going to take just a step back a little bit and just understand from hacker to lawyer is a fascinating transition. And to put that in a technology field is something that you can put some passion and expertise to work. And I'm wondering, is there something in when you think about a deal and an M&A transaction with MSPs, has there been a common thread that has looped deals together, or some perhaps even an interesting challenge that you've seen over and over again, or even just the people that you're dealing with that are typically this information technology professional and people that are really trying to help do the best for the clients. So just generally, what's your impression of what a managed service provider is and why that's a little bit different and that why that specialty matters when it comes to the legal side.
Sure. So I'll tell you, going back now, let's say 20 years ago or so, the type of transactions that we'd see in the M&A space when it came to technology were largely corporate players discussing corporate deals, and the technology was sort of ancillary to it. The players, the people negotiating the deals and that were actually involved really didn't understand the technology. They didn't have much interest in the technology. To them, it was a fungible kind of thing. And so it was more of a corporate experience. As the industry has evolved, and now we're bringing it back to, let's say, as recently as today, what we're finding is that the players involved in the transaction, in the contract negotiation process, actually are involved in the technology solution itself. They may have selected the solution. They may have worked with the solution. They may have contributed to the solution, whatever it is, so that the players are now not just dealing at a corporate level, but in fact, corporate has very often taken a backseat to the technology. What is it? What is the solution being considered here, acquired? How is that going to help certain industries, certain market verticals, and so forth? So I guess, you know, what I have seen in the industry, how it's changed, and if there's a common thread, is that it has changed in that the players have become much smarter and more involved with the solution that they are buying or selling, depending on what side they're on. The thread that links them is exactly that. They have the common knowledge, and it goes beyond just a corporate existence. It's now solution-oriented, and that's a really good thing. I think that it makes for better deals. It makes for more solid deals. It manages expectations better. So I think that that's where that's the common thread that I see right now.
Yeah, it's interesting. So if you take a corporation, and that's an IT department, perhaps even merging with another company that has an IT department, is much different than what we're seeing in that this IT service provider from a third party perspective doing IT on behalf of their clients. I'm guessing that has to lead, the MSPs are integral parts of the client's business. Without yes. them, they're not having the daily information that they need, the systems that they have. It really ties things together. From a legal perspective, does that, how often do things like client assignability come up, or the ability for one contract to go to another? Is that a huge portion that with MSPs that you may not see with other type of transactions?
For sure. So in the MSP space, where MSPs are most often supplying services that they themselves are only resellers of, right? It's not usually a service they provide directly. Instead, they're reselling. So what we find, what you have, is that MSPs have contracts with upstream providers. And in any sort of deal, whether it's an M&A deal, an asset purchase deal, and so forth, third-party consents need to be acquired from those third-party providers. And the issue that we see, and we have to counsel MSPs quite often on, is that these third-party consents cannot just simply be overlooked or summarily dismissed, because very often these MSPs will assume incorrectly that third-party licenses, third-party vendor contracts, and even their own customer contracts, right, can just simply be assigned or transferred without the consent of any other party to those agreements. And that's a significant issue, because not only do are consents often required, but they usually require time to obtain. The MSP has to reach out to the other party, the upstream provider, and explain the situation. The MSP has to reach out to its own customer and explain the situation. So from a timing perspective, it can throw a monkey wrench into transactions unless it's considered in advance.
Yeah, interesting. And sorry to be a little deep in the woods here on a question. It's a fascinating component. Just the from what we're seeing, the MSP marketplaces is so integral to the customers. And this has been a year of transactions. So, Mike, I'd love to hear kind of what Revenue Rocket's done when we're talking to MSPs and how we, you know, what deals have come up, and just give a general marketplace view and perhaps where some of the issues that we've seen from a legality standpoint that have been interesting.
Well, certainly, you know, it's been a very interesting year, you know, for MSPs in particular. We, we've seen certainly a seller's market. And there's been some fascinating developments, and love to get Brad's opinion on as it relates to, you know, the big debate oftentimes is this going to be an asset deal or a stock deal? And the transaction type has changed dramatically for a variety of reasons in many transactions that we've worked on, predominantly due to the transferability of contracts. And, you know, contracts are a big deal for MSPs. They're typically multi-year. They're typically, you know, a situation where they have a great amount of value, particularly to specific types of buyers. We've seen that in particular with private equity. You know, they value those long-term contracts at a premium, depending on the percentage of recurring revenue. And so there's been, you know, plenty of sort of challenges associated with, you know, should it be a stock deal or an asset deal? And we can certainly unpack that a little bit, Brad, and, you know, kind of give your opinion about that. And, you know, there's been other things that certainly have come up on the transactions that we've worked on, not only in the last year, but, you know, over time, that have presented themselves. I'm sure, Brad, you've seen them all, but, you know, maybe you can just, render a few opinions about, well, is it stock or asset? And from a legal perspective, you know, how is that different?
Yeah. So I'll tell you, first of all, I agree with you that it has been a seller's market, for sure. As far as an asset deal versus a purchase deal and so on and so forth. Well, you know, asset deal, I'm sorry, versus a true merger deal. I have seen, for the most part, in the MSP market, far more asset purchase deals than actual mergers, right? So the difference, the primary difference, I mean, there are always issues with accounting and so on, but the primary difference between an asset purchase deal and a merger is that in an asset purchase deal, the purchaser, the buyer, is taking on a known quantity of things, right? The purchased assets, whatever they are, and is taking on nothing else, including liabilities, unless those liabilities are expressly stated in the agreement, right? So an asset purchase deal, we're buying these assets. They are as follows. They're physical assets, intellectual property assets, contracts, accounts receivable, so on, and maybe a few liabilities that are listed. When you have a merger, as you guys know, the acquiring company takes on all of the liability, all of the laundry of the company that it is acquiring. So it's a very different type of deal, right? You have exponentially more issues, a greater number of issues related to liabilities. Then you also have to think about stock and, you know, how is the stock going to be transferred? How is it going to be merged? How are the bases of the values going to be determined and so on? So I think that in the MSP market, what I have seen a lot of are asset purchase instead of true merger and acquisitions, because they're cleaner, they're more precise, they're simpler. You don't have to worry about working capital calculations very often in an asset purchase deal, whereas you do in a merger. You know, it's just a simpler process, and MSPs, I think, right now in their zeal to grow, both economically and from a geographic perspective, penetrate other markets and so on. I think that what we're seeing is they want to go the quick, efficient route. They don't want to take on liabilities. They don't want to worry about stock transfers and so on. I just want to buy your assets. I want to buy your clients. I want the receivables, and we're going to go from there.
You know, Brad, you just brought up a point that I know, as a matter of fact, we went back and forth on in real life, which is you mentioned that in an asset deal, you know, working capital isn't as much of a concern.
I'm not sure, you know, we've seen that. You know, we've seen that working capital pretty much is included. You know, Mike, you're the expert here. What's your thoughts on working capital in an asset purchase?
Yeah, you know, what's interesting is certainly it all depends on purchase price. But, you know, when we represent a buyer, as an example, even if we're doing an asset deal, we require that the seller leave adequate working capital in the business or to meet the definition of acquiring and going concern. We believe that that number hovers around a working capital ratio of one, or kind of a one-to-one coverage ratio, meaning that current assets equal current liabilities. It's appropriate that a buyer would want that in the business in an effort to not have to put in additional working capital immediately after acquiring the business. And matter of fact, over the last 20 years, or almost 21 years here coming up in Q1, that we've been around, we've transacted all transactions with that view, whether it be a stock merger type deal or whether it be an asset deal. And we, you know, whether we're representing a seller or representing a buyer, it's typically typically how we view it and how we've transacted deals. And it's worked out, it's tended to work out fine. I know there's always a lot of ambiguity around working capital. What is working capital? How much is appropriate to be left in? You know, is it appropriate to put accruals into your payables list or not? And I think in many ways, you know, that's a, if you were buying that company, let's say you're a seller, you're buying that company, you'd want that, right? You have to sort of walk a mile in the shoes of the guy that's on the other side of the table and realize that, you know, if you were acquiring a business, you wouldn't want to pour a bunch of capital into it, even if you're buying sort of the assets of that business post-transaction, if you're paying fair market. Now, where this gets a little more complicated is the devil's in the details of how much money is actually spent, right, on the value and whether the valuation was done assuming adequate working capital or not. Because, frankly, if it wasn't, you would discount the offer and then be prepared to put that additional working capital in to manage the business. Brad, your thoughts on that?
I mean, I agree with you. I think that it really depends on their perspective, right? Buyers are going to always want higher levels of working capital, right, to help assure that there's going to be money for the continued operations of the business, right, that it's acquiring. It's not just acquiring a desk, it's acquiring a business, it's acquiring receivables, it's acquiring client contracts and so on. I get that. Of course, from the buyer's perspective, and there's always the yin yang, right, the buyer is going to argue that the seller will argue in the opposite. The seller is always going to argue that the working capital should be low or zero, right? So I guess it really does depend on your perspective. And you're right. We did go back and forth with that a little bit in the transaction that we worked on. We came to a middle ground.
And isn't it always about bringing both sides to the middle to actually get things done? You know, and I think that this brings up an interesting point in terms of the difference between the role of an advisor versus the role of legal counsel. And there's some gray area here. Now, we tell our clients right out of the get-go, we are not lawyers and we do not provide legal advice. However, you know, our history and experience, obviously there's a lot of, you know, contract review and set up for negotiation with respect to definitive agreements and the like. But, you know, there has to be some gray area for you too, Brad, between, you know, providing that legal advice versus what would be considered business decisions.
No doubt. I'll tell you, when we're involved in a transaction, we play therapist, we play attorney, we play advisor, right? Consultant. You wear a lot of different hats. And the idea is that from a legal perspective, obviously you're trying to make sure that everything is done in accordance with the laws. Okay. From a consultant therapist perspective, however, there's a lot of emotion that you're trying
to herd, right, that you're trying to gather and control. And that can take as much time as the legal very often. You know, I would say that the legal end of things is from my perspective, it's always the easier part, right? You know, you tell me the deal that you want. I'll write it up so it's, quote, legal. That's not a problem. We'll write this deal up so it's legal. But you have to tell me about, you know, what's behind what you're doing here. Is there a culture that you're trying to preserve? Is there a expansion that you're trying to engage with? Is there, what's behind it? The legal stuff, you know, making sure the reps and the warranties and so on and so forth are in there. Well, that's sort of commonplace for lawyers, but you really have to delve into the emotions and the desires and the goals, both short and long term. That makes an effective deal. And any lawyer that only focuses on the legal and doesn't really delve into what's behind the decisions is not really doing the right thing for his or her client. That's how I view it.
Hey, Mike, I'd love to get your perspective on that. You know, and this kind of goes into, we've certainly been on this side of the table in which we find that some lawyers can be either be a deal maker or a deal breaker. And Mike, I'd love to get your perspective on kind of that legality versus advisor standpoint, in which we oftentimes have to come to blows with the legal based on some of the counsel that they're giving. And I'd love, Mike, if you have some thoughts and ideas around, what do you see kind of lawyer versus advisor, and what is the right tension to have in an agreement?
Well, that's a great question, Ryan. I think, you know, our experience has been that, you know, most experienced M&A guys, like Brad is here, are deal makers, right? They're people that can help get a deal done and provide great advice, legal advice and counsel on getting transactions tied out. You know, our role as an advisor, as an example, is much more about making sure that the business terms are negotiated fairly and that everyone's on the same page and that there's clear understanding and diligence has been adequately done and that we're moving forward sort of in making sure that 1 + 1 = 3. And then having our client and really both sides of the transaction articulate intent to their respective legal advisors so that they can work through making sure that these deals are documented, you know, in a way that makes sense and is legally sound. I think where we've seen challenges with, frankly, unscrupulous lawyers at times, and there are some of those out there, is when their interest is more in billing than in their client's interest to get a transaction done. And unfortunately, we've had situations like that, even in transactions where the lawyer was on our side of the table when we were representing the same client. And we've had situations where they're on the other side of the table. And it's clear and evident that that is what they're doing. Now, I'm happy to say that that's a pretty rare situation. It can appear to be that way when you have an inexperienced M&A lawyer simply because there's inefficiencies in the process that they're introducing or that they have to go research or things that they have to do in order to try to document it. And then there's just plain the unscrupulous guys that want to run their bill up because that's who they are. And, you know, like I said before, that is not very common. I want to be very clear about that, that it does happen, but it is not very common. And it is a bit of a, you know, buyer beware market. If you're going to look to hire an M&A lawyer, you know, hire someone who's a deal maker and someone who's experienced like Brad, and your life will be much easier.
Yeah, to that end, and I'll give, you know, I'm gonna give some kudos and would love to hear any insights that Brad had in this, you know, recent success that we had, after, you know, what would be considered the first turn of the definitive agreement in which, you know, our client provided,
The first document, clean document, and then Brad made his marks, his red lines, as they say. And we had advised both our client as well as the acquired firm that one of the things that we like to do is put the lawyers together on a phone call and have them reviewing the document together, and do that as opposed to this back and forth of red line, counter red line, strike through, remove, et cetera, et cetera. And because, you know, we find again, you know, when we're dealing with experienced counsels in these areas, that if you can just get them talking to each other, it can be a heck of a lot more efficient. And, you know, that's what we did, Brad. And lo and behold, it was extremely efficient. Anything you can share about that experience?
Not only was it efficient, but it allowed a deal that on all sides, everyone wanted to move quickly. It allowed it to move quickly. So it was efficient and it was effective. I'll tell you, you know, Mike points out a very good point, and it's a very frustrating issue for attorneys in this field, in that you will have unscrupulous attorneys from time to time, and that can come in several forms, right? That can come in the form of an attorney that is throwing in all kinds of loopholes and monkey wrenches to make the deal more grandiose than it needs to be. It could be attorneys that overstaff a deal, right? Sometimes you'll see an M&A deal or an acquisition deal that really could be handled by one, maybe, you know, one or two attorneys, and suddenly it has a staff of six or seven on their side, and everyone's chiming in. So, and when you get into the redlining process and the back and forth, suddenly the process takes on a life of its own, and the deal is lost in the skirmishes that are occurring between attorneys. So, happy to say that did not happen in the deal that we worked on, in which you were involved. We do not participate in that type of thing either, so that's a good thing. And I would say that as far as getting the parties together, it's a great idea. It's a wonderful idea. You know, everyone is bold and strong by email and by redlining, but when you can actually see someone in a conference, a video conference, and they, you know, you can look at them and say, this is important to us, or this is something we can give in on, and you could read body language and have them talk it out. Oh, it's far more effective, so much more effective. I think the old school way of email back and forth, and yeah, we'll put our corrections in a document, you'll find it in the data room and so forth. I mean, it's just an old school way of doing things that's neither efficient nor as effective as it could be.
It's great to hear both the perspectives on this. We all want to get a deal done or understand, and we do want to see the pitfalls and legality issues that are brought forth. But I would say that sometimes a 5-page agreement can be just as good as a 60-page agreement, in some cases, and having the appropriate documentation and legal counsel can really be something that helps people get through a deal. I think there's fatigue all around, and at some point everyone kind of hates each other, and that's when we know that the deal is about to get done. I would love to ask a specific question, but it gets also want to transition into a topic we'd love to cover, which is in general, you know, what is the most important parts of a deal. But before I get into that, have you seen, Brad, any difference in a strategic deal versus a PE or a financially driven deal? Is there anything on a legal front that's been interesting?
I've just seen far more strategic deals these days. You know, from a legal perspective, it doesn't really change the way I approach a deal or the agreements that we're drafting. I've seen far more strategic deals these days as MSPs are becoming wiser to the fact that they need to expand geographically. They need to differentiate their solutions that they're offering. And so deals now are less about the profitability and the, I mean, of course they have to be a profitable deal, otherwise why are we doing it, right? But it's less about the money that's on the table at the moment and more about the long-term strategic relationships that are going to be built and the customer and market penetration that's going to result. So I've seen a lot more of that in the past few years, for sure.
Yeah, very interesting. Yeah, we deal with a bit of both. And I think when we try to piece together a deal, we go back to our trinity, which is there has to be cultural fit, strategic fit, and then kind of financial fit. I think one element to that is that it does it craft it together in a structural fit when it comes to merging entities. And that's where putting together articles in a definitive agreement start to become very important. And I'd love to maybe start even off with the Revenue Rocket team. Matt or Mike, feel free to jump in here. But before it gets to the fine points in the legal portion, what's a critical part of a definitive agreement that, and perhaps Mike, you're great at answering this. Is there parts of a definitive agreement that have the most pushing and shoving that guys like Brad can help get through?
Well, certainly there's the, you know, logical components around working capital, which we already talked about. That's always a discussion. That's always a negotiation, and it usually comes up in the definitive agreement. Even if we try to shape expectations up front, tends to be fairly late in the process. You know, certainly there's all the great work that lawyers do in negotiating reps and warranty coverage on deals on behalf of their respective clients. And, you know, there's times when certainly we're involved in helping to bridge that gap around, you know, what really is the reps and warrants in the agreements, and are they reasonable based on, you know, all of the components of the agreement? And then what's the requisite holdbacks? Oftentimes there's an escrow holdback to protect a buyer against reps and warrants that the seller is making. And or there's other ways to have remedies in the event that there's a, you know, future litigation or challenge to a reps and warrants violation. I would tell you, however, that as much of time is spent on getting those right, which is critically important, I can't think of a deal we've worked on, and we've worked on certainly hundreds of them over 20 years, that has involved a challenge to reps and warrants post-transaction. And I think, you know, that's probably a testament to, you know, just doing thorough diligence and making sure that these documents are actually crafted properly. So that you don't run into a situation where you, you know, have a violation, or you, you know, present a situation. It's exceptionally rare to have, reps and warrants, become an issue. Oftentimes employment agreements become, you know, a little bit of a sticking point, whether someone is a seller sticking around as a contractor or an employee, and what their non-compete language. Oftentimes that's quite a negotiation point that needs to occur in and around a definitive agreement in order to get a deal done. People who are selling their business don't want to be locked out from, you know, particularly if they're younger and not going to be retiring, and don't want to be locked out of the industry. They want to be able to come back in and maybe work in the industry within a reasonable period of time, even though they're selling. And you know, those documents are flavored, of course, by whether an owner of a business is what we call selling in or selling out, right? They're selling in and they're going to be part of something bigger, you know, then oftentimes those negotiations become more material and meaningful. If they're selling out over a period of time, they're dealing with an orderly transition. Let's say it's more of a contractor type arrangement. Then maybe they're not as much a sticking point. But you know, I'd be interested in Brad's point or opinion, or Matt or Ryan. You can speak to this based on your own experience and what you guys have certainly seen become sticking points in definitive agreements. Brad?
Sure. Well, I'll tell you, wow, you just covered the gambit there. So that was fantastic. As I'm thinking, oh, well, how about this? You covered it. You sort of hit everything from due diligence to reps and warranties to employment. I would say that one of the things that I thought about as you were speaking, but oh, this is a good point to bring up because it sort of blends the employment issue, like you said, sell in or sell out, with the financial issue, and that is earnouts. Right now, earnouts and always are related to the purchase price, right? Pricing is always a factor. Is it a cash deal? Is it a cash with an earnout? Is it a stock deal, let's say, and so on? But most often, there's some sort of earnout. And sellers, of course, need to remember that earnouts are going to be linked to the success of the company post-transaction, right? So if you're a seller and you're getting an earnout, if the company does well, then the earnouts are going to be paid. But very often, if the company doesn't do well, then in the definitive agreement, earnouts might be delayed or even terminated at some point, right? So this gets into the question of whether a seller should stay involved in the business, sell in, right? Or and if so, what happens if the seller is no longer in the business? Like, for example, the seller begins as an employee, selling in, as Mike just put it. I think it's a great way to go, a great, great phrase, and then leaves, is fired, right? What happens to the earnout? What happens to the business? Is there a relationship between the earnout and the success of the business while the seller is involved, as opposed to if the seller isn't there? And that gets you into questions of, well, what if the seller wanted to be there, but the buyer fired him, right? Without cause, just fired them. Now what? Well, now the business is going to go down. The earnouts are going to go down. How do you handle that, right? So there are a lot of these issues that involve pricing, earnouts, employment, and they're all linked together. And I think that, at least in the deal that we did, a lot of that, in fact, I'm going to say virtually all of it, any issues involving those that paradigm were resolved because we all sat down and literally face to face and talked it out. So I think that's an important issue and something that sellers and buyers need to be thinking about.
You know, go ahead, Matt.
Well, I was just going to say and reinforce and so, you know, this is just super, super important is that, doing due diligence effectively in the context of getting a deal done, right, versus disqualifying a deal is just absolutely critical to enabling an efficient, you know, definitive agreement process, right? And Brad raised it, Mike raised it, but it's, and that's, you know, quite honestly, the reason that you want to have experienced advisors, you know, alongside you. And that's both, you know, firms like Revenue Rocket, as well as that legal counsel that Brad provides.
Agreed. I think that it's a, due diligence is one of those things that, the parties always underestimate, and it is advisors like you guys that will step in and remind them that, hey, due diligence is not only important, it's going to take longer than you think it will, right? It's going to be more involved than you think it will, and you help manage expectations of the parties. That is a big part of the deal, and it's a great job that you guys do.
Well, in a lot of what you talked about here today, you've talked a lot about everything from your background as a young IT guy all the way through doing deals with MSPs. And I've heard you talk a lot about technology and how important it is with other portions of the larger business. I'd love to hear from you, Brad. You know, why would you, if someone's considering a lawyer and they're running an MSP today, what should they be looking for so they can feel comfortable with finding representation for their MSP? What should they be asking the lawyer?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. But, you know, the MSP industry is a very peculiar industry, different than virtually any other type of industry. It is, it is a combination, it's a hodgepodge of resold services as well as products and services that the MSP itself originates and offers. It involves licensing, it involves IP, it involves so many different aspects, and it is becoming ubiquitous. So it's not only a complex kind of industry that involves technology, it's becoming more and more seen, understood, and used. So all of that said, I think that when an MSP is searching for an attorney, whether it's us or anyone else, to help it with a transaction such as this, first and foremost, you have to look for a firm that understands the industry. Okay, this is not an industry in which a firm should dabble, right? You're not going to do, we do tax law and real estate and wills, trusts, and estates. Oh, and we also represent technology companies in the MSP space. That is a peculiar combination that probably should be avoided. So I guess the first thing I would say is look for a firm that understands the industry, the technologies involved. Okay. And then the second, and probably one of the most important things to remember is it's the lawyer's job to get it done, to get the deal done, get it done in accordance, obviously, with the law, get it done to satisfy the client's short and long-term goals. But at the end of the day, you're there to get this thing done. You're not there to be an obstacle. You're not there to be a wall. Okay. And so clients, when they're evaluating a law firm, should look for lawyers that have that attitude. You want to expand? Great. You want to sell? Wonderful. You want to sell in, sell out? Sounds great. Tell me what you want to do. We're going to get it done for you. So that kind of can-do, get-it-done attitude combined with the knowledge of the industry are the two main factors, I think, that you really need to look for in an attorney or any counsel in this space.
Wow, that's awesome, Brad. You know, and I can't, you know, to just sort of build upon that, getting it done and getting it done efficiently enables the parties to then, you know, effectively start to integrate. And they, you know, they're building trust with each other. You know, if it's this battle, right? Who feels good about that? And, you know, you're going, oh man, now what do we do? Right. And so that's just awesome counsel, Brad. So, you know, kind of to summarize, here, the MSP marketplace is growing in importance, you know, to, that people are recognizing the value of the services being provided because everybody is just relying upon the technology to drive their businesses and make them competitive. And these MSPs, are integral to that. And so the industry is only becoming more and more important. Layer on security, and it's just that much more important. It's a very active space, you know, that's no surprise, but it is just extremely active. There's a lot of money that's interested in the MSP, managed services provider space. But then there's just a bunch of strategic opportunities, as Brad talked about. He's seen more and more strategic deals being done. And you know, so it's just great. It's a great place to be. You see founder-led businesses that have, you know, that have just been tremendous successes, and those founders want to see deals being done or their firms being acquired by other respectful firms. And so, you know, kind of lastly, to get all that done, you got to work with people with experience that understand the space and then again have this intent in helping companies come together, right? And so, you know, Brad, we can't thank you enough. Now, if I remember correctly, Brad, you're going to be doing some speaking here very soon to the MSP community. Tell us about that.
Thanks. Yes. So I'm going to be speaking at a number of events. I just got back from speaking at the IoTSSA event. I'll be speaking at Kaseya's event in Las Vegas in about, what is it now, about a week or so, as well as ConnectWise's event in Orlando in November. And then will be a roadshow to be announced through 2022, which will be going to about 9 different cities, talking about the issues relevant to MSPs, transactions in which you're involved with customers, M&A, purchase agreements, and so forth. It'll all be covered during that time. So they should check in and be happy to give them the updated schedule as it arises.
Well, you better let us know about that too, Brad, because, you know.
Will do.
Yeah, we'll certainly amplify. How do people get in touch with you, Brad?
If they want to reach me, easiest way for information would be to send an email to info@bradleygross.com. They could visit the podcast, which I call the Technology Bradcast. Not podcast, but Bradcast, because I am very clever like that. That's at technologybradcast.com. Or give us a call, 954-217-6225.
Oh, well, awesome. I love the Bradcast. That's great. We're going to need to check that out as well. Hey, Mike, how do we wrap this up here?
Well, big thank you to Brad again for your expertise and sharing that with our audience. We look forward to continuing the conversation at a future date, maybe at one of these events. As Brad mentioned, he outlined how do you get a hold of him. Likewise, you can find more information on our website. We'll put a link to Brad's resources on our website at revenuerocket.com. And with that, we're going to tie a ribbon on it. Thanks to all for listening, and have a great week.